From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It was maybe 3 years ago I saw a movie at the Los Angeles Film Festival called Comet that starts off with Justin Long surrounded by starry night in a frame that looked like it could have been lifted from an early Stanley Kubrick film. And then when I saw the second episode of a series called Mr. Robot, I thought, with the Beethoven Allegretto and the start of the second episode, this man is making his Clockwork Orange homage. And it's gone since from Beethoven to Satie to Simond in terms of music. And my guest is the creator and executive producer of Mr. Robot, Sam Esmail. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And one of the things I want to ask you about, one of the things that strikes me, and I just think about this with Comet, with the show, you have Emmy Rossum and Justin Long in that movie, but in the show, you've got Rami Malek and Portia Doubleday and Carly Chaykin and even Sumitra Mani and Craig Robinson. These actors we think as being comedic actors doing something very different. And I wonder what is that makes you cast them like that, because it's a way of getting people with expressive faces to do something that's different from the way they normally work.
Well, I love faces. I love, you know, it's weird when I talk to my cinematographer. We love wide-angle lenses up close, but not every face you can do that. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what the formula or the chemistry that makes it so that Rami can just handle it, and he looks amazing, and he looks great and expressive. But I love getting inside people and inside their brains and not having them necessarily say anything to communicate something. And that's what I see when I audition, when I cast these people. That's the first thing that I want to see. I want to feel is that, what do their faces tell me without the lines.
But these are actors who have almost anime eyes, you know?
Right.
I mean, they have big expressive eyes,
yeah.
Which is basically really great for comedy because they can do takes. But you have them doing almost takes in dramatic terms. And that's,
right.
I think that's something that's really specific to you.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I find it moving. I don't find it comedic, and I find it loud without it being overwhelming or too on the nose or anything like that. I find their rage or their love or their, you know, or their anger really coming out, and you know, with no holds barred, and yeah, it's, and also the comedy. I mean, I think they can also bring the comedy and the levity to the show, which sometimes the show needs that, you know?
Well, that opening monologue that you give Rami at the very beginning of the show, which takes me back to the opening monologue that Justin has in Comet, which is that thing of what Justin even says, I think, in Comet, narcissistic personality disorder.
Right.
That sort of need for the person to sort of impose their worldview on everybody.
Right.
And you have two characters, two protagonists doing basically the same thing.
Yeah, I think there's a double-edged sword to that, because I love telling stories about our sort of shaky confidence in the reality that we live in. And it feels especially relevant given everything going on in the world today, but the world does feel unreliable, and our instincts in that regard are to either distort it to how we see it, or hopefully to reach out and maybe find a way to connect, even though there might be chaos around us, and to make some sort of to reason with it in some way, to find some way to understand it. And both of these characters are sort of stuck on that one end of the spectrum, which is I don't understand it, and I don't want to understand it, and I want it to understand me, and I want it to conform to what I see.
But also, it's so much of these shows are about the power of one person trying to impose a worldview. If you look at the first couple of seasons of Mr. Robot, now it's third season on USA, I should say this year, you go from having a character who is quite active to the second season, which I thought was really brave, where he's basically on the sidelines. You turned him into a supporting character in the show, which I love that it drove people so crazy.
Right.
You did
that. I love
that,
yeah.
And you must have taken a certain kind of perverse pleasure out of that.
I did. I mean, there's this tendency, especially in TV, to repeat yourself, especially if you have a season that was successful. When you go into the next season, just do it again. You know, change a little bit of the pieces and make it bigger. And you know, spend more money and make more lavish set pieces. And you just repeat, rinse and repeat. And it's really predicated on that, and it works a lot of the time. I mean, in fact, from season to season, shows tend to do that, but sometimes they do that from episode to episode. The thing about Mr. Robot was, because it was originally envisioned as a feature, there is this one story that I'm telling, and that obviously requires different stages that we're going to show in Elliot's journey, and that's never going to have that sort of repeatable quality that you tend to see in TV shows. And so when we went into the second season, I always compare it to Empire Strikes Back, which is something that Lucas sort of did in that movie, where he sort of isolated Luke Skywalker, the hero, away from the action. And then you really focused on literally his sister as she's sort of leading the revolution. And that was to us, that was a really strong parallel we drew in the writer's room. But we felt it was necessary given where Elliot was at the end of the first season. If we had been too pat about or been too glib about the fact that he made this really big revelation about himself and his psychology and just kind of glossed over that and moved on to the next piece of action, we thought that did a disservice to the character. And we also felt that what was interesting wasn't to gloss over that, but that was the interesting thing to explore. And then it also just gave us a chance to sort of widen the world of the show and really get into the characters that we did introduce in the first season, but not really got to know until the second season.
And it's also so much so, you bring up The Empire Strikes Back, and even Portia's character, she's almost dressed like a stormtrooper much of the time. She's grays or whites or blacks, doesn't she?
Right.
I mean, in visual terms, that's really, that second season, The Empire Strikes Back was really kind of a visual correlative, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because Angela, the Portia Doubleday character, really did become, you know, there aren't any straight heroes and villains in this show. Everyone sort of lives in that gray area. But the way we sort of draw those lines is, you know, what Todd, the cinematographer, and Anastasia White, my amazing production designer, and Kat Thomas, my amazing costume designer, gotta give shout outs to everybody. We come together and we say, well, how do we visually tell this story in a way that, because the story is going to be nuanced, the story is going to have all these gray areas and not very clear cut moral lines between our heroes and villains, but how do we indicate that in other ways? How do we show that, represent that in other ways? And color is a big part of that.
No, it really is. And I was really struck by that, because there's so much detail in this. I think people try to like look for things and they miss things, I think. And the costume, just the way that the Carly's dress, she's almost basically in costume all the time.
I mean, she's literally wearing, I believe, like a revolutionary soldier's jacket. So that's the thing. It's like we really kind of go for it. We're kind of bombastic when it comes to the stylistic flourishes. But it's to drive home that point that even though these characters, I mean, even though Carly may not act like literally like John Adams, we want her to kind of come off and appear that way and underline that point.
She's just missing a tri-corner hat, and she could basically be that.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I just thought that was really interesting, too, because in also that's a visual term. Joey Badass is almost set up as Yoda to some extent.
Yeah.
And it isn't it?
I mean, come on. He's talking in sort of Seinfeld wisdom, you know, these like little fortune cookie one-liners. And
they're basically Yoda-like epigrams, aren't
absolutely,
they?
Absolutely, yeah. And he's kind of unusual, and you don't know where he's from, and you don't know where he's going, and he's almost supernatural in the show, and that's what I love about that character. Yeah, I mean, we tend to lean into archetypes. We just sort of distorted it into what the world of Mr. Robot, how these archetypes would kind of live in this world, you know?
It's a treat. We're talking about Mr. Robot, and I think probably everything with Sam Esmail, who's the creator, executive producer of the show. But I really do like Comet a lot, because what you're so interested in is tone. I think you need faces to put tone across, because you rely on silence as much as you do dialogue. And I just thought, watching the show and that movie, it always reminds me of what Martin Scorsese said once, was you cast a comedic actor in a dramatic role, it makes it more interesting because of their facility with language.
Absolutely. And there's an interesting contrast to it that they sort of, what do I want to say? They sort of bring this weird energy to it that when clashed with the dramatic moments, there's a alchemy that happens that you don't get otherwise. You know, the one thing that I always try and do whenever I create a character or write a character or envision that character is that I want to turn it upside down. I want to find out what happens when you do the opposite of what I anticipated the character to do. Because that, to me, that unexpectedness, that spontaneity, that to me is when you can start to see some real human behavior, some real kind of real life character stuff that I don't think can exist on, in my brain or on the page.
You also have theater actors, too. You've got Michael Christopher and B.D. Wong, who can do that same kind of thing, help make create that same kind of tension and also doing it without speaking sometimes, too.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, I consider those guys Shakespearean actors. And the thing about Shakespearean actors, and traditionally you think of them as people who just do drama. Well, Shakespeare... it's all about comedy, too. And it is the blend of both. I mean, the one thing that I hate about any movie or TV show that I watch is that when you start going down the, this is a very serious story that we're telling. This is a very serious thing that we're saying. And this is a very serious feeling that I'm feeling right now. It starts to dilute sort of the color palette of human behavior, which includes comedy, which includes levity, which includes that sort of, I keep going back to this word, but that sort of spontaneous energy that I don't think you can get by leaning into one side or the other. So it's probably why I tend to lead more to comedy actors when casting for a dramatic role. But in the case of B.D. Wong and Michael Christopher, they can do both. They blend both in ways that are amazing and surprising to me. I mean, and I don't even, you know, part of the luxury I have of casting people like that is I step out of the way and they choose the moments where I'm like, that's totally inappropriate to be funny in that moment, but go for it. Or they surprised me with something really moving when I just thought it was a throwaway or an exposition, you know, Michael can find a way to just like sneak one in there where it really hits me in the gut.
I guess I was thinking about in that second season when he just sort of says, well, you know, today is really my birthday, which is all those things you're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny and just kind of tragic at the same time.
Yeah.
But it's also, too, your characters are doomed with the kind of self-awareness because at a certain point, nobody's listening to anybody else in the show. Are they?
No. And because one of the main themes of the show is loneliness, right? And I don't consider the show to be, and this is not something that I don't think I intended, but in looking back on it, I realize it's not really a relationship drama. I mean, we don't really have a lot of relationships on the show. There's no really romantic relationships, and the one marriage that we have on there is kind of, those two characters are dysfunctional to say the least, and not really together. And then, you know, but what we do is explore what people are like by themselves, which I just find infinitely more amazing. And it's a lot trickier, I think, to pull off. But I think there's something interesting about that. And then once you do the work of exploring that loneliness, well, then what happens when you release them into the wild and they start having to interact with themselves? And then you get scenes like that where Philip Price tells Angela, you know, you want to celebrate my birthday today. You know, I think that's fascinating.
Well, we're going to take a break to take our second act. It's a treat from my guest, Sanders Mail. He's a creator of The Terrific Mr. Robot. Also, see Comet. Do yourself a favor. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I'm jumping for joy over here with my guest, Sam Esmail. He's the creator and executive producer of Mr. Robot, now in its third season, by the way, with The Treatment. I guess what I find so interesting about this season, too, is that it's like a slow awakening for him, though. It's sort of like he's blinking now. And the other thing, too, is you cast actors who don't blink very much.
Right.
It's almost like watching Children of the Damned or Eminem.
Well, it's weird. I actually think blinking is I've gotten a little psychotic about it to the point that maybe I've asked editors to cut out the blinking.
Is that true?
Well, I not too much because I've backed off a little bit, but I do think...
But nobody blinks in the second season of the show. It's almost almost nobody blinks.
Right, right. That's semi-intentional. And but also, because I do think that blinking does there's a reaction to that. You have a reaction when people do that. I mean, in fact, it's written in screenplays sometimes. That character blinks.
It's almost like taking a breath.
It's almost like taking a breath, or it's almost like that character's stuck and doesn't know what to do or how to respond or what to say. So I just love to use everything. I mean, this is what I was saying earlier. I'd love, why not use that? Why not use take away when you don't want that communicated or put it back in? And so especially nowadays with the way post is, you can do a lot with visual effects and you know, a lot with Avid. And I try and milk that as much as possible.
Because I just found that really interesting. I guess we should talk. This is the point where you tell people what the show is for those. I realize we've been talking so much in sort of grammar terms about the show. You let people know what Mr. Robot's about.
Well, the show, I mean, this is a tricky question because I always just say, well, the show's about hackers. And because sometimes people say it's about hacking, and that's really not what it's about. The show isn't really about, you know, just showing you computer screens and people typing and magical things happen. But it's really about the subculture of hackers. And what I mean by that is, you know, we follow this character, Elliot, who's got this sort of anti-establishment, bring down the man mentality. But really, where does that come from? Where is that rooted? And that goes to the larger theme of what the show is about, which is loneliness in the context of today, in the context of a modern society. Society where technology, which was meant to sort of allow us to communicate and bring us closer, in a lot of ways has divided us.
It's also about, too, and I think I mentioned this to you when I met you, when I told you I saw you doing your Kubrick in the very start, and that's what made me get excited with the very start of the second episode. It's really a show about being a person of color, being not seeing yourself, and that's that sort of weird loneliness that the culture causes for people of color.
Well, it's 100%, you know, the weird thing is that, and again, that's not something that I intentionally did because I was just, when I write, I try and represent what I know to be true, what my world is. And that involves people of color. And then I think what's interesting about what we did was we didn't let our characters be defined by that. They weren't, it wasn't about the fact that they were a person of color. It was just, you know, that's who they were, and that informed what they did and how they behaved on the show. But it wasn't a defining principle of that.
But it's also the thing where you stop and somebody steps to a lectern and sort of say, well, this is what it's about. And it's just so much of the show, and clearly this is something that you design, operates in subtextual terms. And just Elliot being that detached, for me, in metaphorical terms, really worked as what it's like watching the world going around you, not seeing yourself in
right.
it. As a person of color.
Yeah. I it's weird. I don't know if that's something reflective from my own experience, but I do think, you know, with technology, especially with the advent of social media, there is an identity issue here. And I know that we've definitely explored that on the show, but think about what we do on a day-to-day basis, you know, from Facebook to Twitter to then how we text people to how we are at work, how we are at home. We're really curating and creating all these different identities for ourselves of how we think we are, how we think we want to be, to who we really are, maybe behind closed doors, and what we're secretly doing online versus who we are openly online. And part of and I think, you know, you raise this topic of color because I think that has gotten to a especially in this country, a real boiling point. It's really become, and I think because of that, it's really because people can be sort of more vocal about who they are and their identity, and it really sparks a lot of divisiveness and online because that avenue wasn't there before, and it's kind of a weird personal experience that's forced into the public arena. And I, you know, I don't know quite what to make of that yet.
Well, part of it too, and I'm guessing this, and we talked a little bit about this when I met you, comes from just the way you grew up. I mean, you don't, people like you and me didn't see ourselves reflected in the mainstream. And what's happened now with all these social media avenues you're talking about is we get to create, in effect, a subculture, an underground for ourselves.
Right.
We communicate with people like ourselves, and we can curate a world that exists like that. But the mainstream still, in fact, doesn't include us.
No. And if they do, they include, it feels like a homework assignment. It feels like, I mean, even with this new advent of diversity, We need more people of color behind the camera and in the writer's room, et cetera, or on screen. It feels like a homework assignment. It feels like...
But they used to call them in the 80s a very special episode.
Exactly. It feels like it's about that. It feels like it's about, oh, this person is African-American, so, we got to talk about the struggle and the urban and the whatever. And really, it really goes into this really, for me, in a weird place that still doesn't do the job of reflecting our experiences or what we grew up as people of color. And because in my world, in my life experience, it wasn't necessarily always about that, but it is different. And that subtle, see, the thing is, it's like, I'm glad people don't quite get it just yet, because it gives me the opportunity to take advantage of it. Because the awesome thing about it is that you have all these points of views that are going to be so fresh and new and original that no one really is aware of. And as a storyteller, I know, because I'm curious about that, because I'm interested in that, I can go and take advantage of it in a way that's like really, and we're starting to see it. I mean, Wonder Woman being a superhero from a female's point of view, suddenly everyone's like, oh my God, we got to do more of that. But again, what's great about that is that we saw it literally from a woman's point of view, from the creation of it. And it wasn't just about sticking a super, sticking a woman in a superhero.
It wasn't just like that creating an opportunity that disappears once the opportunity has been exercised.
Exactly. And I think that's the missing part, is that, I mean, and that's what I hope changes eventually, is that this isn't about, stop treating this as a homework assignment. Stop treating this as a pat on your own back, and start treating it as a way to curiously tell interesting stories from all these unique points of views that aren't there yet. The stories aren't there yet.
Because what the show is so much about to me is that all these points of view that are different people, from Sumitra to BD to Carly. I mean, to everybody is a different person here. But at no point does anybody say, this is who and what I am.
Right. Well, do people act like that? Do people?
They do on television.
They do. In fact,
you even satirize it in one of the episodes.
Right. And that's bad storytelling. And honestly, and to be fair, I like the attempt because it's awkward for them. But that comes from also the people behind the camera, or the people who are writing it aren't people of color. And that becomes the big part of it, is that they're trying to write, from the outside in. They're trying to say, well, what would a person like this do? And they treat it like they're kind of like diagnosing an alien or something. You know what I mean? But here it's like, no, we get to, being a person of color, I know that we don't talk like that, or we don't talk about our heritage like that.
Or all the time.
Maybe it's a couple of times, but it's more about the unique perspective that I have growing up in America is different than a white person might have. And all those little details, like I think one of my favorite shows is Aziz's show, Master of None. And he does that so beautifully. And he does touch upon the fact that he's obviously a person of color, but it is so subtle, and it's really about the details, and that unique perspective is what I think is going to be really exciting in storytelling.
It's the treatment. We're talking about Master of None. The show we really are talking about is Mr. Robot, with its creator and executive producer, Sam Esmail. I think, though, for me, the show finally is what it's like to use cinematic language for television. And some part of you must have been thinking, I've been waiting all my life to do this, because there's been shows that have attempted to do it and have done it in some ways. Going back to the 80s, really one of the first shows was Miami Vice, which was one of the first shows to use cinematic language, in visual terms, having a real... Mel Bourne was a production design consultant on that show, and he brought some of those, let's say, perquisites to television. But it's not only just in visual terms that the show works as cinema, but even in aural terms. I mean, the way not only music is used, but the way sound is used.
Yeah, sound is a storytelling device. So we use it to foreshadow. We use it to do callbacks a lot of times. And what's great about that is one of the great things about sound is it can't really be on the nose. I mean, it really can't. I mean, you could say music can get bombastic and all of that, but sound effects is something you can go subliminal with in a really interesting way.
Well, that's the Kubrick of it all, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it works. It works so well. You hear it, you feel it, but nothing's telling you what's happening or what's going to happen or what we're paying off or calling back to, but you completely feel it. It's emotional. And that's what I love about it. I mean, think about music. Sometimes you just listen to music just to feel something, and it's all purely tone. I mean, half the time, I mean, the way I listen to music, I don't even necessarily pay attention to the lyrics all the time. I just listen to the vibe of it. You know, it's like an IV shot of pure tone and emotion and
well, it's like that, going back to that Allegretto, which is not something Kubrick ever used in the music, but he should have used in the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's that thing you're talking about. You go, oh.
It immediately just transforms you in a way. It either gets you to sit up or it seduces you into a lull. You can do whatever you want. You can sort of control behavior. And in contrast with what's going on to the screen, that's when it can get really, I always go back to that word contrast. A lot of times when we pick music or even when we look at sound design or sound effects, we do the opposite of what we're seeing on screen. If it's a serious moment, we're playing a pop song. If it's a funny moment, maybe it's played more dry, or maybe it's played with more of a drone or a tone.
I mean, if you're using something like Genesis, for example, you can't help but laugh when you, wait, what's, they're using a Genesis song?
Right. But what we're watching is a guy that's essentially being terrorized and being blackmailed. And so, and being asked to burn money in the middle of a square. And the great thing about it is it just, that alchemy only exists when you start playing around with these tools, but if you just play everything straightforward, you're really doing, I think, a disservice to that experience.
I think part of it too is that what this is all about for me, it goes to what I was saying, interestingly, it's a contrast, because the movie and the show about people not hearing each other, at no point do we actually hear a conversation. Somebody's saying something and offering their point of view, and then the other person's offering their point of view, but nobody's listening to anybody.
Right.
But you're using all these other things to make us listen. So right. you're playing and using all these tools to play with irony.
Yes, to play with that contrast, and that's probably something, that's my own stuff that I think that I'm trying to work out, but that's the stuff.
How do you mean your own stuff you're trying to work out?
Well, I think that's how I feel. I think I feel, and that's the thing I relate to with both characters, Del in Common and Elliot in Mr. Robot, but even more characters in Mr. Robot world. There's a disconnect that I feel.
Well, Darlene is that too, though.
Darlene is that too. Angela.
Oh, my gosh. But she's become that because she is so empathetic that she's seen to be in pain the entire first season and becomes a mask-like. I mean, so, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I mean, I think I sense that disconnect with people. I think sometimes it does feel like we're just talking at each other. But where is that connection? Are we feeling that? Are we doing that? Does it exist right now, given, like, think about like what Facebook has done. I've noticed this with a lot of my friends. Because of Facebook, they don't see their family members as much. They don't call their family members as much. In fact, when's the last time I've even talked to a friend on the phone? That doesn't happen as much, because what you do instead is you text or you send an email or you look at pictures on Facebook, and that's enough. You don't need to actually go visit the baby. You've seen the baby, you know, on social media. So there's a weird divide here. I mean, it really is sort of the thing that we thought was going to unite us is the thing that's dividing us together. And I'm not, and that's not like a glib thing or an observation I'm just trying to gloss over. I really think there's sort of an epidemic here. There is that weird disconnect. And it's something I felt that I've always had a sense about, that I've imbued in my characters. And that's ultimately, I think, in hindsight, when I look back on what I did with Common and Mr. Robot, that's what I want to talk about.
I can't believe we're out of time, but we're out of time. Will you please come back and do the
absolutely,
show?
Absolutely, for sure.
My guest is Sam Esmail. Of course, the show is Mr. Robot. Please see the movie Comet. Our recording engineer at NPR West is Theo Mondo. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Bright, who's associate producer. I'm not on Facebook. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.